is infinitely loving. And I might point out that the most crucial attribute there is the simplicity of God. Because if God had parts in him, then he could be partly loving and partly something else. But if he doesn't have any parts, then he has to be wholly everything that he is. Consequently, the simplicity of God seems to be, if I may use the term, the belt that holds together all of the attributes of God. Because otherwise, one of the attributes could apply to part of him, and another attribute could apply to another part of him. There he could be partly loving and partly just, and you could separate them. But if God is a simple being, then whatever he is applies to his whole being, not to part of his being. And what's happened today is the simplicity of God has been attacked. In fact, evangelical theologians are giving up the doctrine of the simplicity of God. Walter Dorf from Calvin wrote an article on several years ago, rejecting the simplicity of God. I believe Alvin Plantinga rejects the simplicity of God. Merrill Westfall, back as early as 1966 in the Review of Metaphysics, rejected the simplicity of God. And from there on, evangelicals have been buying more and more into process theology. Donald Blesch, for example, has bought into process theology. Clark Pinnock, to some degree, bought into process theology, all because they've rejected the traditional attributes here. Finite goddess rejoices in that, because God is not infinite in both power and love. Furthermore, a finite God, like all other finite beings, would need a cause. That's the principle of causality. Every finite needs a cause. If God is finite, then God needs a cause. If God needs a cause, he's not God. So finite godism turns out to be a creatureism. Finite creatureism, not finite godism. Also, a finite being is not a religiously worthy object of worship. For a finite being is less than ultimately good, less than completely good, and what is less than ultimately good is not worthy of an ultimate commitment. I wrote my doctoral dissertation on the nature of religious experience, concluded that Paul Tillich was right, that the only thing common to all religious experience is an ultimate commitment. But he also said, you should not make an ultimate commitment to anything less than an ultimate. You shouldn't make should not make an ultimate commitment to a country, a person, or a thing, because they're less than ultimate. The only one worthy of an ultimate commitment is an ultimate. The only one worthy of perfect obedience is a perfect. The only one worthy of worship is one who intrinsically has absolute worth. If that's so, then a finite God would not be worthy of a religious commitment, because a finite God isn't ultimate, perfect, absolute, infinite. Hence, a finite being is not worthy of worship. Finally, a finite God cannot guarantee the defeat of evil and the triumph of good. That's the point that Carnell is very good at. William James has an interesting quote. I think we have it in the book Roots of Evil. He said, the universe is better for having the devil in it, providing we have our foot on his neck. And what he means by that is, it's kind of good to have the loyal opposition around. It's good to have, you know, someone to keep you on your toes spiritually. Well, certainly a world with evil in keeps you on your toes if you're about the process of doing good. But such a world is only good if you have your foot on its neck. But a finite God doesn't have his foot on the neck of another finite being. It might be that the other finite being, the evil one, has a stranglehold on God. In fact, that's exactly what Schubert-Ogden, the process theologian, say is the motivation for doing good. God is finite and he needs our help. An infinite God doesn't need your help, does he? He can do it without you. But if you really believe God is finite, then and you are really needed, you got to hop on the bandwagon and let's all push and get the God up over the hump here, because he's in trouble in the world today. And that becomes the motivation for doing good. Schubert-Ogden says you serve God because you are doing something for God. But what can you do for a God who has everything? What do you give to the man that has everything? It's like the old joke. The guy comes to the counter and says, "What do you have for the man that has everything?" She said, "Envy." You know, I mean, what do you have? What do you give to the man that has everything? Worship. But to a God that doesn't have everything, but needs help, who is sincerely struggling against evil, join in and help him struggle. Now, Carnell says, he flips that over and says, wait a minute. If God is not in control, then he might lose. Even with our help. Because, frankly, we're not helping that much. Look around. Then evil might win in the end. Then we might be on the losing side. Then all of your dedication to good will be for naught. Because you lose in the end. You know, when the Jedi strike back, you will lose and not be victorious. So what cannot guarantee the defeat of evil cannot solve the problem of evil. There is no solution to the problem of evil with a finite God. All there is the prospect of a struggle that will go on in which maybe nobody will ever win, or evil may. Another option we don't have open to us, determinism. The claim that God could not avoid creating this kind of world. This is an interesting one because it comes generally out of a pantheistic worldview, but some theists have bought into it, that God had to create this kind of world. First of all, a finite contingent world places no necessity on an infinite necessary being. How could a creature that could not exist ever force a creator who could not exist? On the face of it, this seems absolutely absurd, that there is some necessity placed on a necessary being by a contingent being. A contingent being doesn't place any necessity on anything. A contingent being is itself contingent on the necessary being. The only thing a necessary being must will necessarily is its own necessary being. God doesn't have to do anything. He just has to be God. That's that old principle of plenitude we talked about yesterday. The good is diffusive of itself as a pantheistic premise. God does not have to overflow. He wants to, but he doesn't have to. Hence, God was under no necessity to will a finite world. But what one is under no necessity to do, he is free not to do. Hence, God was free not to create any other world. Incidentally, in the book Problem of Pain, C.S. Lewis comes very close to denying this theistic premise himself. He said it may be meaningless to ask the question, what other possible world could God have created? Now, if it's meaningless to ask that question, then God must have created this one. If God must have created this one, then he was not free. In other words, C.S. Lewis thinks that freedom should be understood only in the sense that nothing compelled God from the outside to create this world, but that he was compelled from the inside. You've got to be very careful with that. If God was compelled from the inside, then what compelled him? And if he was compelled, how can he be free? It's always been the classic doctrine that God could have not created anything. If he had to create this kind of world, then he was determined. Determined by what? Determined by his own nature. Well, his nature only determines that he be good. His nature doesn't determine he do anything. Seems to be a category mistake. Natures don't determine. His necessary nature only determines the necessity of one thing, his necessary nature. But his necessary nature doesn't necessitate any other necessary thing. In fact, seems to me, it necessitates that every other thing will have to be contingent, because he can't create another necessary being. He can only create a contingent being. If it's contingent, it might not be. If it might not be, it didn't have to be. It didn't have to be, then it freely was. Well, there you go again, right around the circle. Furthermore, 4:2, there is no obligation on a perfect God to make an imperfect world. even if God were somehow internally, morally obligated to make this world, how can you say he was morally obligated to make a bad world? Because this world right now is bad. And there's another mistake that theists make. We sometimes leave the impression that this is the best of all possible worlds. In fact, that's what Leibniz said in his great book, Theodicy. This is the best of all possible worlds. And if you want to read something funny, read Candide. Voltaire, the famous French infidel, wrote Candide as a satire on Leibniz's view that this is the best of all possible worlds. And this poor guy, every conceivable evil that could happen to him, happened to him. And he keeps jabbing in, but this is the best of all possible worlds. I can tell you how to improve the world. One less murder today. World will be better, right? And you don't have to have a great imagination to think of a few other sins that might not happen today. It'd make it a better world. If this is not the best of all possible worlds. And to say that God was determined by his nature to make an imperfect world somehow doesn't fit. That leads us to impossibilism. Maybe it was impossible for God to foresee or defeat evil. Let's take the first argument for impossibilism. It was impossible for God to foresee evil would happen. The future can be predicted only where there is a necessary order of causes intervening. For example, line up 10 dominoes, push the first one, you can foresee that the last one's going to fall. Why? Only because there's a necessary order of causes in between. That it's necessary that when one falls, it's going to hit the other and it's going to fall. But how can you foresee where there is not a necessary chain of events? Neither can God foresee. Therefore, God didn't know this world was going to turn bad. He made it good. And he gave freedom, and he doesn't know what's going to happen with the freedom. I read a process theologian 2 years ago when I was doing a paper on process theology for a new book that is coming out. And in this, the process theologian used this phrase. He said, God is finite. He cannot foresee the future. God waits with bated breath to see what's going to happen. Doesn't that make you feel good? You put your head on your pillow tonight that there God is in heaven. Wow, that was a close call, you know. He's waiting with bated breath to see what you're going to do next. Well, that's not exactly a secure, cozy feeling that you have, a trusting that kind of universe. But the other hand is, how do we answer the argument? You can only know the future if you can foresee a necessary order of causes. You cannot foresee what free acts are going to do. Therefore, he cannot know the future. 17.5.2, theistic answer to the first argument. First, God's knowledge of an event does not prove the event was not freely caused. Just because God knows something is going to happen doesn't mean that it wasn't free. God's foreknowledge means only that the event must occur, since God cannot be wrong about what he foreknows. See, if God is omniscient, and if omniscience knows everything, then he can't be wrong about what he foresees. If he foresaw that Judas was going to betray Christ, then he must be right about that. Well, you say, well, then Judas must have betrayed Christ. He wasn't free not to betray Christ. No. God foreknew that Judas would freely do it. And God must be right about the fact that Judas will freely do it. So there is no contradiction between predestination and free will, unless you misunderstand one or the other. If you misunderstand predestination to mean forcing people to do things they didn't want to do, then of course you have a problem. Or if you understand free will to be that man is free and God doesn't know what's going on, then there's a problem. But if you understand that God knows what man is freely going to do, there is no problem. It does not mean, however, that God cannot know the event will occur freely. that is, as a result of human free choice. Thus, the event could be necessary from the standpoint of the ultimate cause, that should be God, necessary from the standpoint of the ultimate cause, God's foreknowledge, and yet free from the standpoint of the immediate cause, human free choice. You say, was Judas' act free? Yes. It was free from the standpoint of its immediate cause, Judas, but it was determined from the standpoint of the ultimate cause. It was both determined and free. And there is no contradiction in saying something was determined and free. Secondly, the timeless God of theism does not foresee anything. So there is no problem of foreseeing. He just sees an eternal now. See, if he's an eternal God, he's not temporal. The whole problem is set up by assuming God is standing on a line looking forward. God is not standing on the timeline of past, present, and future looking forward. God is in eternity looking down, and all of those are now to him. The future is now, the present is now, and the past is now. So he doesn't foresee anything. He just sees it. Now, if you see it, there is no problem in foreseeing. And the whole problem set up by this chain of events, having to foresee, is dependent on God being a temporal being. So it's a category mistake of assuming God is a temporal being, and therefore there's a problem. Yeah, there is a problem if you're a process theologian, or if you're inconsistent, maybe it'd be a kinder word than the one I was thinking of, evangelical theologian, who's bought into part of process theology and say, well, I believe that God is infinite, eternal, and unchangeable, but I think he's temporal. Can't be both. If he's unchangeable, he can't be temporal. If he's temporal, he can't be unchangeable. Therefore, if you buy into that, there's a problem in seeing how God can foresee the future. But if he's an eternal God, there's absolutely no problem at all. He sees it. 5.2.2.1. There's a real difference between seeing what men do with their freedom and forcing them to do things against their free choice. Timeless God sees all future free acts from and in eternity. They are eternally present to him. Hence, God can know with necessity what men will do with their freedom. At best, the objection of impossibilism proves only a kind of necessitarianism, but not a determinism. That is, it is necessary for it to occur in accordance with God's knowledge, but it is not determined against man's free choice. Christianity to hold that.
Does Gordon Clark hold to a form of determinism?
Yes.
He believes that God created evil?
Yes. See, there is another solution to the problem of evil. It's what I call a gutsy Calvinist. Gutsy Calvinist just says God can do anything he wants. If he wants to do evil, he can do evil. I, the Lord, create good and evil. Isaiah 45. I mean, I've asked Gordon Clark that directly at dinner, you know, and sitting right across eye to eye. He doesn't blink an eyelash to say that. He said God is in sovereign control of the whole universe. He's a double predestinarian. God predestined hell, predestined heaven. He creates evil. Anything he does makes it good because he did it. It is good because God does it. God does not do it because it's good. That's called voluntarism. In ethics, it's not essentialism. Well, it's kind of irrefutable. That's it. That position is almost as irrefutable as a real, true pacifist. If you ever talk to a real, dyed-in-the-wool pacifist, you say, well, now, wait a minute. If somebody was going to shoot your wife, certainly you would kill in self-defense. Why would I want to kill him? He'll go to hell. My wife will go to heaven. Well, there's no answer to that, is there? I mean, it's just... You just stop right there, you know. You admire the guy for his convictions and move on, because it's irrefutable. The guy who's killing, obviously, is going to hell. His wife's a Christian. She's going to hell. Why should I kill him and send him to hell? And my wife's going to heaven. Finish the next answer, then. The second argument for impossibilism is for the impossibility of God knowing evil would happen. Whatever God knows in advance is true, for God cannot know error as true. And what is known by God in advance cannot be changed, since an all-knowing God cannot change his mind about what is true. But what cannot be changed eliminates freedom, for freedom is the ability to do otherwise. Hence, if God has foreknowledge, then men are not free. But men do have freedom, so God does not foreknow what evil would come as a result of man's freedom. This is turning the tables on us now. It's saying, okay, if God knows the future, if it's present to him, then it's determined. If it's determined that Judas would betray Christ, then he wasn't free not to. If he wasn't free not to, then he wasn't free. Why blame him for doing it? Theistic response. First, freedom does not mean that one will do otherwise, but only that he can do otherwise. It is not that he would, but that he could do otherwise. That he could do otherwise does not mean he could if God willed otherwise. It means that he had the power to do otherwise even when he did not use it. It means that whatever we bind on earth by our free choice will have already been bound in heaven, which incidentally is the proper way to translate that in Matthew 16:19. Whatever we bind on earth will already have been bound in heaven. So it's a beautiful illustration of how our freedom and God's divine sovereignty meet. Because when you decide it, what do you prove? You prove what already had been decided from all eternity. When you say, I do, was the marriage made on earth or was it made in heaven? Both. Because when you say, I do, what you willed on earth already was willed in heaven from all eternity. So the marriage is made on heaven, but it's only discovered on earth, and it's discovered by a free choice. One night I was talking to a Hindu at Northwest University, and he said, if God knows who's going to be saved, and I'm not one of them, then even if I believe, I can't be saved. Now what's wrong with that reasoning? What's wrong with the reasoning is that he's engaging in a category mistake. I said to him, if you believe right now, you will prove that you are one of the ones that God willed. And I can guarantee you right now, if you accept Christ, that you were one of the elect. See, he had the cart before the horse. Because whatever you bind on earth will already have been bound in heaven from all eternity. What's the big mystery? There's only a mystery if you assume a false view of omniscience and eternality of God. There is no problem with free will and sovereignty if you don't. Secondly, 5:4:3, a timeless God sees future happenings in his eternal now. Hence, there is no problem of being known as true in advance. He knows now. Thirdly, God is responsible for creating a world that could become evil, even if he didn't know. Even grant them their premise. What if God didn't know? He certainly knew what could have happened. Why don't you make free creatures? I mean, he's not that dumb that he doesn't realize that freedom means they could do otherwise. And he's not that dumb that he didn't realize that they might do otherwise, and that this might cause a great problem. So he's still responsible for making free creatures. Hence, impossibilism does not really exonerate God by claiming he did not know what would happen. It's like the old attractive hazard law. If you place an attractive hazard there for the kids in the neighborhood and they come and play on it and break their leg, you're responsible because you did know what could have happened. You didn't force any kid to get on the big swing and swing out over the creek, but if he fell in and drowned, you're responsible for an attractive hazard. Well, God certainly made an attractive hazard with free will. He's responsible for the consequences from it. Okay, the argument of impossibilism that is impossible for God to defeat evil. This is the third kind of impossibilism. even an omnipotent being cannot do what is actually impossible. The law of non-contradiction applies to reality. But what is actually impossible is contradictory. Hence, actual impossibilities cannot occur, whether by finite or infinite power. God can't make a square circle, or two mountains without a valley. But it's actually impossible for God to defeat evil. For to defeat evil, be necessary to destroy free choice. Since as long as men are free, evil is possible. As long as evil is possible, then it's not yet really been defeated. So evil cannot be defeated without destroying free choice. But to destroy free choice would itself be an evil for God. For God willed the good of man's free choice, and for God to go against the good that he's willed would be evil. But God is all good, and he cannot will or do any evil. Hence, God cannot defeat evil. Now, that's a very powerful argument. In fact, I think it has a lot of truth to it. I think of that argument as the number one argument to focus what God's number one ingenious idea in this whole plan is. Here's the problem. How to create a free universe, not force anybody's freedom, but still defeat evil and bring about a permanent state where evil cannot contaminate the universe and everybody's still free. Now, if I may say so, and I'm sure God is just tickled to death to hear me say so, he must be a genius. That is a brilliant idea. You can create totally free creatures and still defeat evil without destroying their freedom. You've got to have a few tricks up your sleeve. And as you see the whole plan unfolded, that is exactly what is happening. Everybody is given their freedom, and yet finally their freedom is fixed, not from the outside, but from the inside. Good and evil are separated in the universe. Evil is quarantined forever. Everybody is assigned a place according to his will, not against his choice. Thy will be done. But evil can no longer contaminate good. No more evil to bother good people. No more good to bother evil people. Evil is given its day. It shot its wad, so to speak, in the Las Vegas of life. Lost. And good is triumphed forever. But according to people's free choice, no one in heaven who didn't will to be there, no one in hell who didn't will to be there. But once you're there, you're bound, like in marriage. Fulfilled freedom, not destroyed freedom. Hell fulfills your freedom to have the light stop bothering you. Don't flash that light in my eyes. Keep it on my eye. Okay. You like darkness forever? Heaven fulfills your freedom to see the light. That is really clever. That is an ingenious plan. And that's precisely what God has done, and it answers this problem. He has defeated evil, or he will defeat evil, without destroying freedom. Okay, first, the argument against impossibilism claim. First, it was not necessary that God create free creatures to begin with, and if God knew free creatures would bring evil that he could not handle and defeat, then it would be evil to permit an evil he could not handle. But an all good God would not, indeed could not, do what is evil. Hence, an all good God would not and could not make this kind of world. But an all good God did make this kind of world that became evil. Hence, God could have known in advance what evil creatures would do. Secondly, it's impossible that evil can be defeated without destroying freedom. Evil can be defeated without destroying freedom. Why? Evil can be defeated by eternal quarantine, isolation. Quarantine can be in accord with free choice. Therefore, both freedom can be present and evil can be defeated. Leads us to the atheist claim that evil exists but God does not exist. And I want to go through various atheistic arguments, but let's stop there.
Is hell within the creation time? Is it within the universe or is it outside of the universe?
Everything is within the universe by definition.
So that evil is still within the universe?
Yes.
But it's just contained?
Yes. It's contained, it's quarantined, it's defeated, it's stultified. it's, as it were, eternally separated from God. It can no longer infect his plan. See, the problem today is the wheat and the tares are growing together. But Jesus said, allow that till the harvest, because it must be that way. That's one of the problems with the amills today. They're trying to separate the wheat and the tares, set up a theocracy. This is the tendency we have now in Francis Schaeffer and that whole movement, and Rosh Dooney and the whole theodicy movement. I think that's wrong. You have to let good and evil grow together until the harvest. Live and let live. We're a pluralistic world. We can't set up the kingdom in that world. God is going to set up in the end, but that's only when it's separated, good and evil. But that's all part of the universe. Nothing's outside of God's universe. Nothing's outside of creation. Hell is part of the created universe. But it's not a part that's going to affect it. In fact, it's a part at which the good will look with great satisfaction and sense of justice. You were probably too young to remember the actual experience. I'm sure you all are. Eichmann. But you all read about Eichmann. And you know who he was and what he did. Frankly, there was a kind of sense of justice there when Eichmann was captured and tried and capital punishment and burned, cremated, and his ashes thrown in the Mediterranean. You know, I mean, after all, you mastermind the murder of 5 million people or 6 million or however many it was, genocide. That's the least that could be done, is throw his ashes in the Mediterranean. I mean, that doesn't even atone, so to speak, for the crime. And I think hell will be looked at in that way from this eternity. I mean, there's a sense of relief that they can't break out. And that's one of the problems. You put a criminal in jail today, he's killed somebody, and he may break out before the trial. If he doesn't break out before the trial, he's sure to be there a long time after the trial. He could break out again. There's no real relief. If you've never sensed that, then you've never had anyone close to you killed by murder and gone through the trial. Our closest friend's daughter was stabbed 17 times by a rapist. Died in the policeman's arms 2 minutes later. Police station only a couple blocks away. And that rapist almost got free. She gave the name of the rapist to the policeman before she died, name and where he lived, and he still almost got free. There were 3 eyewitnesses who saw him stab her. In this way. When you take all of what we call good out of something, what's left? Nothing. When you take all of what we call evil out of it, what's left? Something better. So that proves that good is the positive and evil is a negative. For example, take all the holes out of this garment. What do you have? Whole garment, better garment. Take all the rust out of your car. Better car. Now take all of the good out of the garment. What do you have? Hanger. So, take all the good out of your car. What do you have? Brown spot on the pavement. Totally rusted. There it is. So, good must be the positive and evil must be the negative. Atheism claims that evil exists, but God does not exist. Besides the fact that we've already given a rational argument for the existence of God, let's handle their negative arguments against God. First, Russell, Bertrand Russell, why I'm not a Christian. If there's a moral law, then it either results from God's fiat, his arbitrary decision, or not. If it results from an arbitrary decision, then God is arbitrary and not essentially good. But does not result from God's arbitrary decision or fiat, then there is something beyond God to which he is subject and he is not essentially good. That is, he is not ultimate. So either God is not essentially good or else he is not really ultimate. He is not good because he is arbitrary about what's right and wrong, or he's not ultimate because there's a higher law to which he is subject. But a God who is not essentially good and or not ultimate is not worthy to be called God. Hence, there is no God, at least not in the theistic sense of the word. In our response to that, we point out the moral law is based on God's unchangeable nature as good. Russell has a false dilemma. It's not either something outside of God or God is arbitrary. It's something inside of God, namely his nature, which is unchangeably good. So he missed a third alternative, set up a false dilemma. Hence, the moral law neither proves that God is arbitrary nor less than ultimate. Indeed, the very reverse can be argued. For if there is an ultimate right and wrong, a moral law, then there must be an ultimate standard for right and wrong. There is an ultimate right and wrong. That is, there are unconditional duties. Even humanists hold that man has an unconditional duty to mankind. Hence, there is an ultimate standard of right or wrong, a moral law. The laws come only from lawgivers, prescriptions only from prescribers. Hence, there must be an ultimate good moral lawgiver, God. He must be ultimate because he's the source of what is ultimately binding. He must be good because he's the basis of what is called good. He cannot be arbitrarily good because his nature is unchangeable. Hence, God must be essentially good. So two points there. One, Russell's argument fails because he overlooks the third alternative. The law doesn't have to be outside God. It could be inside God, his own nature. And two, if such a moral law exists, then Russell is wrong because his argument boomerangs on himself in that it shows there must be an ultimate moral lawgiver. The second argument of atheism, that evil exists, but God does not. Pierre Bayle, David Hume, many have laid down this argument. Evil exists. An omnipotent God could destroy evil. Omnibenevolent God would destroy it. Evil is not destroyed. So either God is impotent, malevolent, both, or no God exists. But a theistic God cannot be impotent or malevolent, powerless or evil. Hence, no theistic God exists. And we respond by pointing out two things. One, if you take destroy in the strong sense of the word, then you'd have to destroy freedom to destroy evil. The only way to destroy evil is to destroy the very possibility of evil. Freedom makes evil possible, therefore you'd have to destroy freedom. In the weak sense of the word destroy, namely defeat, we argue that God is going to defeat evil. And if you pick up at 6:42, however, God can defeat evil without destroying freedom, because whatever an all-good, all-powerful God can do will be done. He's all-powerful. He could defeat it. If he's all-good, he would. If it's not yet done, then that argues infallibly that he will yet do it in the future. And the guarantee that he will do it is that very omnipotent nature. So what turns out, what looks at first to be a liability to theism, an all-powerful God who doesn't look like he's accomplishing his task, in the end turns out to be our greatest asset, because it's the assurance that it will be done. If he's got that kind of power and will, and it hasn't yet been fulfilled, then his nature is the guarantee it will be fulfilled. Therefore, everything that argues for theism argues for the ultimate triumph over evil. And you might say, conversely, everything that argues against theism argues against any ultimate triumph over evil, namely a finite God. Third argument for atheism, that evil exists and God does not. An all-good, all-powerful God would not allow innocent suffering, but there are instances of innocent suffering in the world. Therefore, there is not an all-good, all-powerful theistic God. We respond by pointing out an all-good, all-powerful God would not allow innocent suffering unless it is necessary to produce a greater good. There is no innocent suffering in the world which is not necessary to produce a greater good, that is, unjustified suffering. First, it is possible that innocent suffering is necessary as, first, a direct result of the exercise of finite freedom in the world. There's a lot of evil we bring on ourselves. We make our bed and we have to lie in it. Secondly, much suffering may be a result indirectly of the use of full freedom as the condition, concomitant, or byproduct, which we'll discuss a little more under point 20 in the end. In other words, it might be that this kind of world is not the best of all possible worlds, but it may be the best of all possible ways to obtain the best of all possible worlds. and that this kind of world, with evil as a condition, concomitant and byproduct, is the only way that you could allow the full exercise of freedom and bring about the greatest good. Hence, the real question is not whether suffering is innocent, but whether it is necessary. If you could prove that it was necessary to have this kind of world, and therefore this kind of suffering, then you've answered the objection, because we don't need to answer whether or not there is innocent suffering. We need to answer whether or not the suffering there is necessary for the full exercise of freedom and the attainment of the greatest good. Therefore, it is not incompatible with the theistic God to allow innocent suffering if, one, it is necessary for the full exercise of finite freedom, and, two, it can be used to achieve the greater good. And what atheist would want his freedom cut off, and who could prove that the greatest good is not going to come as a result of this kind of world? One would have to be omniscient again to prove that that's impossible. Therefore, the only way the atheist could press his argument all the way is to assume omniscience. He's assuming God to disprove God. All we have to show here is it's logically possible that an omniscient mind has some good reason. As a matter of fact, if it is logically possible, then it's logically necessary, because an omniscient mind, by virtue of his omniscience, must have a reason, and an omnibenevolent being, by virtue of his omnibenevolence, must have a good reason. So if God is omniscient and omnibenevolent, he must have a good reason for the evil that we yet can't explain. The fourth argument for atheism, 17.67, if suffering is justifiable, then it is wrong to work to eliminate it. Or in so doing, one would eliminate the conditions for achieving a greater good. But it's not wrong to work to eliminate suffering. It's right to do so. Hence, suffering is not justifiable. But if suffering is not justifiable, then the theistic God does not exist, for his existence is incompatible with unjustifiable suffering. That's a good argument, because it answers in turn to ours. We said evil is a precondition for good. They say then you can't work against evil, or you're working against the precondition for achieving the greater good. Our response to it is, it would be evil for either God or man to promote, to produce or promote evil as a direct end or goal. We do not will evil. We do not promote evil. And to encourage suffering, or even not to work against it, would be a promotion of evil as an end. But it is not evil for God to permit suffering, which would result from the full exercise of freedom, as a means of producing the greater good. So the main distinction there is between, you don't beat your head on the wall because it feels so good when you stop. That would be promoting evil to produce a good. But you do go to the dentist and permit evil, the pain, in order to produce a greater good. So yes, God does permit evil to produce good. No, God doesn't produce or promote evil to produce a greater good. In fact, not to permit evil, 6.8.4, in free creatures would be an evil, since it would be a violation of their freedom. As if you don't permit anybody to do any evil, then you don't permit them to be free, at least not to exercise their freedom to do evil. Hence, it would be evil for God not to permit evil as a means of attaining a greater good, for two reasons. First, because it would be an evil to violate the freedom he gave. You can't give freedom and not give freedom at the same time. You can't say you're free, but don't do what I don't want you to do. Secondly, it would be an evil not to permit the conditions of a greater good. If you don't permit the conditions, then you don't permit the possibility of achieving it. However, since promoting evil is an evil, neither God nor man ought to promote evil means, such as suffering, in order to produce a greater good. Fifth argument of atheism, on the basis of evil, a holy, good, and holy powerful being would eliminate as much evil as possible. But not all the evil that can be eliminated is eliminated. Almost any one of us with more power could improve the world conditions. Therefore, there is no holy, good, powerful being. The response to this is, first, it is possible that God has eliminated all the evil he can without destroying freedom, and that this is the best world actually possible. That's always a logical possibility. It's always logically possible right now that God is doing everything in his power to eliminate all evil short of violating free will. I mean, granted free creatures, it's logically possible right now this world could be no better than it is. Now, it's always logically possible that there could be less evil, but he would have to diminish the freedom in order to attain it. In other words, you can see easily how God could take care of a lot of evil, just let a lot of sinful people not perform those sins. We could do it in our society by behavioral control. We could do it by shock treatments. We could do it by splitting the two sides of the brain. We could do it by a peace pill. We could do it in many ways, but all of those ways would be a limitation on freedom. So it's logically possible right now that there's no way to have a better world than the one we have without destroying freedom. But if freedom is the greatest good for moral beings in the free exercise thereof, then it would be an evil to destroy the freedom, and it would be a greater evil than the evil one is attempting to overcome. So, secondly, 17.702, it is possible that God is not finished yet, but that he will eliminate more evil in the future, and that we are on our way to the best world possible. It's always logically possible that this is only a preliminary stage to the final development, and that the whole show is not over yet, and God is well on his way to accomplishing that ultimate purpose. In fact, you and I, from a biblical point of view, indeed believe the second one. I find it difficult to believe the first one. The first one is an a-mil solution. The second one is really a pre-mil solution. But the first one's logically possible. I find if it is logically possible, there's something down in my soul that says it's kind of morally repugnant. I find it difficult to believe the first one, even though it's logically possible on moral grounds, that this is the best God can do. It might be, but it just looks to me like that surely he could do better than this. And then with the little hint that I get from the Bible that he is going to do better than this by letting everyone choose and then permanentizing their choices in the great separation, the great divorce of heaven and hell, then I can see eschatologically that this world is just the best way to the best world, but it is not the best world. So I call my theodicy a best way theodicy as opposed to the best world theodicy. Leibniz, taking the clue from Augustine, said, this is the best of all possible worlds. And he used what I call the aesthetic illustration. You look at a painting, let's say, a shaded painting with only black and white in it. And that painting needs dark places to contrast with the light places, otherwise you couldn't get any beauty out of it. So it is with life. You need evil to contrast with good, but the total picture is good. Or Augustine said, look at a mosaic. Get real close to a mosaic, and each little piece looks ugly and broken. You stand back, and you see the whole picture is good. Now, that's an a-mil explanation, because they're saying right now, the way it is, the whole picture is good. And it takes both good and evil, light and darkness, to make a total picture of good. Now, I find that kind of pantheistic and morally repugnant, because it's really saying that somehow evil is good, rather than evil is evil and may be a training ground or a condition for good. They're saying that somehow evil is good, and they're pronouncing evil good rather than saying this is an evil stage necessary as a precondition, like pain in the dentist chair or pain on the operating table, to achieve the greatest good. That leads us to the next point, which is dualism. Dualism's claim that evil is a co-eternal substance. Now, there are a number of dualistic views. Zoroastrianism is a dualistic view. Manichaeanism was a dualistic view. Taoism is an unusual kind of dualistic view, where you have both sides, the light and the dark, the good and the bad, in the one force, such as in Star Wars. But most ancient dualisms were two different substances, both eternal, one good and one evil, locked in a deadly conflict forever with each other. Augustine belonged to a dualistic Manichaean cult before he was saved. And as a result, some of the best material against dualism is found in Augustine's volume in the Nicene Fathers called the Anti-Manichaean Writings of Augustine. Here's a summary of some of the material he gave. The basic argument for dualism: good and evil are opposites. Nothing can ever be the source of its opposite. Hence, both good and evil must have existed as eternal opposites. But good is a substance, that is, there are good things. Therefore, there must be a co-eternal and opposite evil thing. The basic dualistic argument against theism is, according to theism, God is the creator of everything, but evil is something. Hence, on its own premises, God must be the creator of evil. Hence, the theistic God cannot exist. Now, our reply to dualism's two arguments. First of all, answer to the first objection. Not all contraries are based on first principles. That is, not everything that's contrary are both of them first principles. For example, short is contrary to tall. That doesn't mean there's something eternally short and something eternally tall. Good and evil are contraries which are not based on first principles. There is a first principle of good, namely God, but there is no first principle of evil, since evil does not exist in itself, but only in good things, as the corruption of them, the next point will show. Hence, there is no co-eternal first principle of evil. In order for their argument to work, they would have to prove that all contraries are based on first principles. But there are a lot of contraries that aren't. Right and left, tall and short, fat and skinny. Doesn't presuppose that there needs to be an eternal fat and eternal skinny person. Answer to the second objection: God is the creator of everything. Evil is not a thing, it's a privation or lack. First, whatever God creates must be metaphysically good. For God is absolutely good and cannot do any evil. God created everything that exists. All perfection comes from Him. Hence, everything which exists is good. Like God, the cause is good. Secondly, evil has no essence of its own, really exists only in another. For when evil is removed from something, it remains pure. But when good is taken away, nothing remains. So nothing can be totally evil in a metaphysical sense. When we're talking about total depravity, we're talking about moral depravity, not metaphysical depravity. Even Satan, who is totally morally depraved, has a being. He has a good being, because God made it. He has good intelligence and good free will. Whatever God created is good. So Satan is metaphysically good while he's morally evil. You can't have something that's totally metaphysically evil, because a totally rusted car is an orange spot on the pavement, and a totally moth-eaten garment is a hanger. Hence, God is not the creator of anything, since there is no evil thing. Third objection to theism from dualism: if there are no evil things, then evil is not real, and the result is illusionism. But illusionism is not right. Evil is real, as we admit. Therefore, there are some evil things, which is incompatible with theism. And they're pulling a pantheistic critique on us, saying if we deny that evil is a real thing, we're denying the reality of evil, and therefore we're reduced to pantheism. Our response is evil is real, but it is not a real thing. It's a real privation in things, and privations are real. For example, sickness is a reality. It's a real privation of health. It's real to be sick. To be maimed is real. It's a real privation of a limb. Blindness is real. Close your eyes for a week and walk around. Even a day will convince you how real it is to be privated of sight. So we're not saying that evil is not real. We're saying that evil is not a real thing. It's a real privation in things. Note, privation and mere absence are different. For example, neither the blind man nor the stone has sight. But the absence of sight in stone is not a privation, because the stone doesn't lack sight. Sight is simply absent. Doesn't lack it because sight is not part of the nature of a stone. Therefore, it's not losing anything it ought to have. But sight is part of the character of a man. Therefore, the lack of sight is a privation. It's something that should be there, but isn't. Hence, God is the author of all things without creating any evil thing, and yet evil is real, a real privation in the thing he created. Fourth objection of dualism against theism: if God is the author of all reality, then he must be the author of evil, which is real, even if it's not a real thing. That is, if God is the author of all reality and evil is a real privation, then God must be the author of the privation called evil. But if God is the author of an evil privation, then he is evil. They don't give up. This is kind of the last stab at trying to prove that it's inconsistent. Our response: God is the author of the possibility of evil, but not the actualization of it. For both finitude and freedom make evil possible. Finitude makes evil possible because whatever is finite is composed, and whatever is composed is decomposable. Hence, finitude makes evil possible. This is a very important argument, because finitude makes evil possible, but it doesn't make evil actual. Only freedom makes evil actual. But the very fact that something is a creature means that it can decompose, because all creatures are composed of at least essence and existence. Everything that is could not be other than God. So the evil of destroying itself, or the evil of accidental or substantial change — there are only two kinds of change that can occur, substantial or accidental. Substantial, it would go out of being. Accidental, it would change in its being. Evil is a change in the good being that God made. So only beings that can change can undergo evil. But any being that can change has the possibility for evil. A being that cannot change and is already good has no possibility for evil. But freedom makes evil actual. If creatures are really free, then they are free to do good or evil. But if they are free to do good and evil, then evil is possible. Hence, freedom makes evil possible, and all you would need is a free act to make it actual. Just the fact that somebody has freedom doesn't mean he is going to do evil. But if he does do evil, then he is actualized by his freedom. But a finite good is the only other kind of good God can make. It's impossible to make another infinite or uncomposed good. Freedom is good. It's not evil to be free. It's good to be free and to do good. But if one is really free to do good, then he's free not to do it. And freedom not to do good is what is meant by evil, namely doing the not good. But to create the possibility of evil via finitude and freedom is not necessarily an evil, provided a greater good can be achieved by it. But an all-powerful and all-good God can and will achieve a greater good by creating the possibility of evil. If he did not, he would not be doing his best. Hence, everything which exists is good, like God its cause. Secondly, evil has no essence of its own. It exists only in another. For when evil is removed from something, it remains pure. But when good is taken away, nothing remains. Finally, 737, dualism implies a third and ultimate norm. This is another argument against dualism, taken from C.S. Lewis. For either good is ultimate and evil is measured by it, or else both good and evil are measured by a norm superior to both, which is the ultimate. But in both cases, there is only one ultimate norm, which is contrary to dualism. It's a very succinct argument, and I think correct. The only way you could measure them is to measure them by one or the other. If you measure one by the other is ultimate. If you measure both of them by a third, the third is ultimate. In either case, there can't be two ultimates. There can only be one ultimate. And if you made evil the ultimate, then that which is the lack would be all the ultimate. And if you add the lack argument, that evil is the lack of good, good is not the lack of evil, then you could show that it must be the good that is the ultimate, of which evil is the lack. Yes, if by that you mean that the limitation of certain people's freedom, like those angels, was not really an intrinsic violation of the overall plan that you allow free people to exercise their freedom. It's that there's also a categoris paribus, all things being equal, in that statement. And it's this: I have full freedom, but my freedom ends where your freedom begins. So a sovereign God must intervene and protect the freedom of the innocent as well as permit the freedom of the guilty. But the permission of the freedom of the guilty ends where it would be a destruction of the freedom of the innocent. And that's the whole logistic problem that God has in doing so. Now, apparently, the angels that are in prison were doing sins that would lead to a destruction of God's whole plan of permitting the free exercise of beings and the ongoing of the race to continue his plan, and therefore they were put in chains. But anyone who doesn't use their freedom to destroy the possibility of the freedom of others to attain God's ultimate goal, God will allow them to use their freedom. But if they use their freedom to do that, then of course he has to intervene. Let me give another example. Wicked Queen Athaliah was going to kill little Joash in the Old Testament. Little Joash was the only surviving heir to the Davidic dynasty. There were no other people who could have fulfilled the promise that God had made to give a Messiah through the son of David. That would have meant prophecy was wrong, the Messiah could not have come and fulfilled prophecy, we couldn't be saved. The whole plan of redemption depended on little Joash remaining alive. Now, I firmly believe, and he was hid in the temple and protected, you remember, and then later brought out on throne. I firmly believe that if she had gotten in there with a knife to stab him, that the knife would have turned to jello, because God would have had to have supernaturally intervened to preserve the bloodline at that point. There were no other parents left, anybody to produce any more children. If not that, he would have had to recreate somebody or do something, because a miraculous intervention was necessary to keep the whole plan going. This is why we hear these stories about miraculous intervention, and then we hear other cases where missionaries die in plane crashes, you know. Why? I think the rule is this, and only an omniscient mind can know. Who is necessary for the ongoing of God's greater plan to accomplish the greater good, and who is not? When someone is and something is, there's a supernatural intervention. When it's not, then as the three Hebrew children said, and as Esther said, to use her words, if I perish, I perish. You know, I go, and it's just as great an act of faith, perhaps greater, to say, I'll go and die, than I'll go and God to protect my life. That's the best I can make out of that, and only an omniscient mind can know just exactly who is and who isn't, and what is and what isn't, in order to balance this whole process, because obviously God cuts off some people's freedom, cuts off everybody's freedom at death, but obviously cuts off some people's freedom who are about to do evil to others. Then there's some he doesn't. I mean, he didn't catch all those babies that were thrown up and caught on bayonets, you know, or shot in the arms of mother in Vietnam. God didn't intervene in those cases. In other cases, you hear stories. I remember one of a baby that was saved. There was a big tornado went through in the little crib there, and there was two great beams over top of a crib and an automobile right on top of the beams, and the baby was unscratched underneath. Well, in the mystery and the providence of God, Nahum says, the Lord has his way in the whirlwind. You'd have to be omniscient to know why that baby was saved and others were caught on bayonets. There's just no human way. And at that point, I think Ecclesiastes and the book of Job comes in, that the ultimate solution to the question of suffering is submission to the sovereignty of God. I mean, that's the message of the book of Job. The solution to suffering is submission to sovereignty. But that's not blind submission. If he is sovereign, if he is all good, if he is all powerful, then I have good reason to believe he has some good reason for this, even if I don't know what the reason is. The way I put it is, I know why I don't know why, but I don't know why. And it's of some comfort to know why you can't know why when you can't know why. It's of no comfort not to know why, and not to know why you can't know why. I know why I can't know why. I'm finite and limited in my perspective. But I know someone who does know why. He's infinite and unlimited in his perspective.